Well, thank you for your kind invitation to be with you again here in Cornwall. Thank you to the band as well, leading us there in our worship. And having a weekend here in Cornwall when we made that arrangement months ago. I mean, why would I not want to come and be with you again in Cornwall? But I wasn't expecting it to be quite such a lovely, summery, sunny weekend. But great, the family could come down as well. But because of that, I didn't put much sun cream on yesterday. And staying near St. Ives Bay, we spent a good bit of time outside, and I'm a bit pink now. I'm pinker than normal. I'm a rare steak or something today. But Mark chapter 5, this passage that really fits with some of the things I was sharing to those who were here last night as well on the ministry of Jesus around the Sea of Galilee. And I want to share with you some thoughts from this passage, which really relate perhaps to the time that we're in right now. I mean, we're coming out of this strange old period of COVID and lockdowns. And if there's one thing that the last couple of years has maybe taught us, is that maybe we don't need all the things we think we need. You know, we live in a culture which we're constantly being pushed to think that we need more stuff, we need more things. And yet the last couple of years, what have we most needed? Well, we probably missed fellowship and physical contact and relationships and so on. The things that matter most aren't the things that are constantly being promoted. So to get us started, before we look in detail at this passage, let's just think for a moment about the things that we most need. What is it that we really need? Well, if you look at the advertising around, and I just did a little scour on the internet, here are some things which I didn't know I needed, but you can now buy. These are products and items which we are being sold. There is, and you might want to explain to me why we need some of these. Diet water is one example. Diet water, I'd never realized that there could be such a thing as non-diet water. Glow-in-the-dark toilet rolls. I mean, there is a light switch in most toilets, so I don't see the need, but I guess some do. This one looks lethal to me, though tempting. Bathe and brew shower coffee maker. So you can make your coffee while you're in the shower. There is an appeal, actually, in that to me, but I just think it looks dangerous. And then this one really needs explained to me. Colgate toothpaste for men. Because there is this thing about selling things for men and for women, you know, cycle helmets, whatever, for men, for women. But why you would have toothpaste for men? I don't understand what the difference could be in teeth. Well, we are sold all these things. We are told we need various things, and yet perhaps this last couple of years, we've realized that the things we most need, life, health, friendships, love, fellowship, these are the things, of course, that money can't buy. And they remind us that at its heart, the things we most need are things which will draw us back to the gospel, to the good news. That actually what Jesus Christ came to bring addresses not our superficial needs, but our deepest needs. And this particular story this morning is an issue of health and wellness. And that must be pretty high on our list of needs, that we would be well. And you have two people in this story, two stories in effect, two people who are at the end of their tether over issues of health. One is a parent with a sick child, and the other is a woman with an unhealed bleeding. And for these two, this is their most important need, it would seem, at this moment when they meet Jesus. And think about this for a moment. Many of you will relate to this. There are the issues that you may face in health that you worry about, cause pain. But maybe even worse than that are the issues of health in the people you love. And that can be even harder to bear. Those you care about and those you love, and you would do anything to remove that pain from them. And that's why we kind of, as our first title this morning, Desperate Measures. Because those deepest needs we have make us desperate. We can't just buy our way out of the problem. £100 or £1,000 won't solve a problem like this. So here's the setting, verse 21. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Now, Bit of background, and as some of you know, if you know me or have heard me before, I'm particularly interested in the archaeology of the Holy Land, and especially the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. So that's where I've been involved for some time. And that's meant that as I've got to know that northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, for me, these stories, they come to life in a kind of archaeological way. When you think about the locations, the geography, the topography, and some of the remains that have been found. So forgive me if archaeology is not your thing, but I can't help it. I cannot help talking about these stories and thinking about the actual setting, what we know of that setting from the archaeology. So a little bit of background to this story, where we are and what we're seeing. In chapter 4, Jesus had been teaching in Capernaum from a boat. Crowd had gathered, so he went out on a boat, and from the shoreline, he taught the crowd. And then he was tired. Here is God incarnate, who we read was tired. And he withdraws, and he heads over to the other side of the lake. That would mean he went from the west, where Capernaum, to the east, which is the more Gentile side of the Sea of Galilee. And there was a storm, and then he gets over to the eastern side, and there's a fantastic story. I was going to preach on it this morning, but I changed my mind what I was going to preach on. But there's a fantastic story of the pigs and the demons, remember? Great story. I was really pulled which one to go with. Anyway, there's the encounter with the pigs and the demons on the east shore, Gentile territory. And then after that, Jesus is now heading back to the other side of the lake. In other words, back to Capernaum. And if we read the Gospel of Luke and Matthew, who tell us the same story, but they give us different details, we read in Matthew that it was Capernaum. That's where this story takes place. He's back in Capernaum. And we know a lot about Capernaum. You see on the screen there, this is the interior of the synagogue in Capernaum, which is pretty stunning. It's all really been excavated since the 1960s. That's when archaeologists really got to work on Capernaum. One of the most spine-tingling locations where you can go to in Capernaum. It's astonishing. It was found in the 1960s, but it is the earliest church building ever. It's an octagonal shape building. It's quite small. The octagonal shape building, this is the foundations that were excavated in Capernaum. It's very close to the sea, where the trees are in the distance. That's the shore of the Sea of Galilee, so it's right close to the Sea of Galilee. And these are the foundations, and this is like 8th century, these octagonal kind of shape. It's what they call Byzantine. But the very, very center of it, the tiny section at the center, is a first century house in Capernaum. A simple, modest house in Capernaum that in the decades that follow was expanded into a church building. And it raises the question, why? Why did a simple, modest house in Capernaum, close to the shore, become a meeting place for Christians and eventually get expanded into this church? It's only a few yards away from the synagogue, actually. They're within, you know, close range of each other. And the obvious answer, the most likely answer is, this was the home of Simon Peter. This was the home base for Jesus in the Galilee. This is where Jesus would have slept at night. This is where Jesus returned to. Almost certainly, this would be the home that Jesus used in Capernaum. And that would explain why it became kind of remembered for that and developed into a church. And then eventually, hundreds of years later, forgotten, buried in the earth, buried in the sands, to be excavated in the 1960s. Modest, but very significant. And there's the synagogue that was developed as well. Now, this is beautiful, beautiful synagogue, white limestone. Shimmers in the sun. Again, not far from the Sea of Galilee. It's a center of Capernaum. There's an intriguing thing about this synagogue. I mean, the synagogue itself is lavish, very expensive. Would have been much more significant than the little church that was being developed in Capernaum. And it's after the time of Jesus. It's a white limestone, beautiful looking. And it's really from about 300 AD, 200 AD, 300 AD. So it's after the time of Jesus. Until you look a bit more closely at it. And if you ever go out to Capernaum, do take a look at it, because the white limestone captures everybody's attention. But if you look down the side, can't quite see it on this photo, but trust me, I'm a doctor. if you look at the bottom of it, that the bottom of the synagogue is actually built on top of earlier foundations. Black basalt stone, different kind of stone. And they don't quite line up. That's the significant thing about the foundations. They don't quite align. So in other words, there was an earlier synagogue there that was built out of black stone. That was a normal stone they used. And it had been redeveloped into this lavish white limestone synagogue. You're looking here at the very bottom, the dark bit at the bottom. You're looking at the foundations of the synagogue that was in use at the time of Jesus, where many miracles took place, where Jesus preached and taught. It had been redeveloped in the years that followed, but we can now see as a result of the archaeology, the actual synagogue that stood there, foundations of it, at the time of Jesus. Now, why do I tell you all of this? Well, I tell you it partly to remind us that we are talking about real history and real places, and we know more and more about the real places and the real history. And I think also I tell you these things because it illustrates something of the significance of Capernaum at the time of Jesus. It was relatively small, but it was significant. Important trade route, a lot of money passing through at Capernaum. That's why Matthew, the tax collector, he worked there because it was a place of trade and commerce and taxation and so on. And so here is Jesus back in Capernaum, and we read here in verse 21, a large crowd gathers. Now remember, he went to the other side of the sea to escape the crowds, to a quieter place. But now he's back among them. And verse 22, as he arrives back, one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. Now, what do we know about Jairus? We know a few things. From what we've read and from what we know of Capernaum and so on, he would have been respectable. This was an important synagogue. Yeah, it's going to be redeveloped and become even more important, but even at the time of Jesus, this is a big synagogue. It's a wealthy town, Capernaum. Maybe small, but there's a lot of money. Everybody would have known Jairus because it's small. He would have been a highly respected, wealthy, no doubt. So put it together, Jairus was well-known, respectable, wealthy, and desperate. We know he's desperate because of this story. He's run out of options. It doesn't matter about his money or his prestige or his honor. They don't help you when a loved one is dying. And what Jairus illustrates to us is how often faith kicks in when self-dependence runs out. Verse 23, love how tenderly this is described. He pleaded earnestly with Jesus. My little daughter is dying. Notice how tender that is. My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. There's desperation. There's humility. He's fallen on his knees. This is a leader in the synagogue, a respected Jewish leader falling on his knees before an untrained teacher, Jesus. And he pleads earnestly. And Jesus, we read here, responds to his faith. And then he starts a journey to the man's house. Now, it would not be a long journey because Capernaum is not very big. And while he's on the way, on this short walk, he's interrupted by a second character in the story. Verse 25, this second character is a woman who is there, been subject to bleeding 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. Now, what a contrast with Jairus. Let's put these two alongside each other for a moment. We've described a man with a name, with a reputation, and now we meet an unnamed woman. We know Jairus by name. We don't know this woman's name. We met a man who had respect, a role in the community, honor, and now we meet a woman who has an illness, is considered unclean, and is given no name. According to Leviticus, chapter 15, the Old Testament law, according to Leviticus, this kind of bleeding would have made her ritually unclean in Jewish law. And that means she would not have been allowed to enter the synagogue. For 12 years, she couldn't go into the synagogue because she was ritually unclean. For 12 years, she could not have touched or been touched by a priest or a rabbi because she was ritually unclean. And she would have made them ritually unclean if she touched them. So think about this comparison. We're comparing a synagogue leader with a synagogue outcast. You don't get much more different than this. It's not just a man and a woman. There's an absolute contrast between them. And whatever money she had, Mark draws attention to, it's all gone now. Jairus may have been quite a wealthy man. This woman's got no money. I mean, Mark deliberately draws attention to the fact that, that the more she spent on the doctors, the worse she got. So she was running out of money and she was feeling worse. By the way, I find this quite striking because I mentioned to those who were here last night, Luke and Mark tell us about the same story, some of the same stories, but in different ways. It reflects their background, their interests, and so on. It is all the Word of God, under the inspiration of God, and yet their personalities flow through. Now, scholars generally think it makes sense that Mark wrote his gospel first, maybe the earliest gospel, and Luke wrote his later. And Luke says, in Luke chapter 1, he actually tells us, that many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that happened among us. And then he says that you, Theophilus, might have an orderly account. I've now written my account of the events. So Luke probably drew upon Mark's gospel. He knew Mark's gospel. He read it. And there are some passages in Luke that are very, very close to Mark, the way they're worded. That doesn't affect the inspiration of Scripture, by the way. God's Spirit spoke through those writers, so it's the Word of God, but they are different. And it's very striking when you see the differences and you notice the personalities, because Mark, he tells us what's really gone on here. 12 years she spent her money on the doctors and she's only got worse. She's running out of money. Luke, he doesn't tell us that bit. You know what Luke's job was? He was a doctor. And when Luke comes to this passage, he tells us about the woman's bleeding, but he doesn't mention that she'd been spending money on the doctors and only getting worse. This is as if Luke thought, I don't need to tell people that. My colleagues, the other doctors, this gospel won't be quite so effective with them if I draw attention to that little detail. Their personalities shine through in the way that they count what had happened. But verse 27, when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. She thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. I describe Jairus as humble, right? Because he was. He fell on his knees before Jesus. But now we come to another level of humility. This woman won't even fall on her knees before Jesus because she's an outcast. She doesn't dare being branded as somebody who's made this man unclean by touching. And so she comes up behind and discreetly touches the hem of his garment. That's humility. And verse 29, immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. What a beautiful description you have there. Freed from her suffering. Suffering is like a prison. It's like a trap. Our bodies are like that. I mean, we're all in the same situation in that sense. After the age of 21, anyway, I won't ask people's ages, but after the age of 21, our bodies are all in decline, right? That's what the science shows. Bits are dropping off or falling out or growing where they shouldn't or whatever. Our bodies are in decline. And the body can become like a prison. And suffering exaggerates that. And we can't do the things that we used to do. And we are conscious of the aches and the pains. And she experiences freedom in this healing. She is freed from her suffering. And notice, and it's particularly relevant to the story that happened in chapter 4, it is immediate, immediately. It's the same word that was used in the calming of the storm. When Jesus rebuked the wind and the waves, immediately it was calm. Same word now. Immediately she's freed from her suffering, just like the wind and the waves. And then just moving on in my slides. Talk about the faith and the fear that contrasts here. Verse 30, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. It's a strange description, isn't it? It reminds us that Jesus, though he was fully God, God incarnate, he was the Son of God, and he chose to glorify his Father and allow his Father to work through him, and he chose not to know certain things. I mean, you put it together in the Gospels, Jesus knew hunger, we read. He knew thirst. He knew tiredness, we read. Jesus wept at the funeral he attended of Lazarus. Jesus tells us he doesn't know certain things. He does not know the time of his return. Now, that doesn't mean he's not God, but he limits himself to truly identify with us. Jesus took on limitations. And the limitation here is that Jesus has to ask the question, who touched me? He knew power had gone out from him, but he did not know who had touched him. Some people think maybe he's only just saying this in order to get the woman to make a public profession. Maybe he's only saying it so that she has to come forward. But I don't think it reads like that. I think that Jesus deliberately chooses not to know certain things. And in this moment, there's a crowd around, and he does not know. He knows that power has gone out. He knows there's been a healing, but he doesn't know who has touched him. Verse 33, then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. The whole truth there means that that's how Mark got to hear about the 12 years of spending with the doctors and how all the money had gone and how she'd only got worse. He got that information presumably because this woman, now with a crowd around, publicly tells the story. There's humility again. She publicly explains what's happened in her life. But trembling with fear, does that remind you of other passages in Mark? Maybe again it might remind you, if you remember the story, of the calming of the storm. Because when the storm was calm, what's the immediate reaction of the disciples on the boat? They're afraid. They were afraid of the storm. They're even more afraid, terrified, we read. Who is